Hi, my name is Roy Collin, and welcome to the show. I've also got Fight Podcast, The Awakening Podcast, Exposing Fraud and Corruption, but with Solutions, the Crypto Podcast on the road, all things blockchain, NFTs, crypto, the Meditation Podcast, talking about all different types of meditation, but there's also meditations there from 1 minute to 2 hours. And the other one's the Learn Polish Podcast. So if you're interested in learning Polish, you can do that. And the other one is Speaking with Roy Collin. And I just have guests from around the world talking about either public speaking or also about their book or just general life in general. And you find everything on bio.link/podcaster. I'm also a podcasting coach. And you see the QR code there. And it's also on my link as well. And if you're interested in actually going on some podcast shows, I'm helping people doing that. Or if you're interested in sponsorship, you can contact me. And I'd like to thank my sponsor, danielpacker.com. He helps people with anxiety, stress, and addictions. He's got a 90% success rate, and you only pay if you're successful. So be sure to check him out, danielpacker.com. I hope you enjoy this week's show. Welcome to the Speaking Podcast. You'll find all our episodes on speakingpodcast.com. My guest today, combat veteran who served 11 years in the US Army, serial entrepreneur, founding board member of a veteran nonprofit, and the author, Damn the Valley. Please welcome William Yetsky.
Good to be on.
So I can see the book there, but you might just let the listeners know a little bit more about you. I mean, I've just kind of mentioned bullet points.
Well, I mean, like you said, so the experience in the book is about an experience that I had in 2009 to 2010, the majority of it being in 2010, but in the Arghandab River Valley of Afghanistan, to where, I mean, things ramped up to the point to where we had a 52% casualty rate, which is unheard of in modern day deployments. You take a group of what normally is an infantry company, and I think they're supposed to be around 200 at strength. You're never at full strength. So I think we were sitting at about 170, 180 guys. But if you take that number and you just cut it in half and you say, hey, half of you are getting Purple Hearts in one way or another, whether it's losing an arm, losing a leg, and the various other battlefield injuries that you have that are seen. That's not even to account for the PTSD that I'm sure a lot of the guys, anybody who's suffered a traumatic event or occurrence like that, especially extended, you're talking about massive repercussions the rest of their life, depending on how they view that experience and depending on the circle they have around them. So
No, I mean, I definitely want to touch on the book, but I want to find out a little bit more about you because I
not
know
me.
your wife is in the military as well. So one, how you got into the military, and two, what's life like when your partner is also in the military?
Yeah, so we both left around the same time. She left, I think it was a month prior from me. At least the active duty side. She was Air Force. So there it was a little bit of an interesting, really by rights there, wait, you're Army, Air Force, how did this happen? But we met, she was working on Pope Air Force Base, and I was in the area, at Fort Bragg. But one thing led to another, and here we are 8 years later. great marriage and whatnot. But I guess how I joined the military, I joined up a little later than most. I joined up at 26. I had always kind of felt that call and everything, and I was a little bit of an adrenaline junkie. And I was sort of talked out of the military to begin with from my parents. They had said, hey, look, we think you should go to school first, and then from there, possibly join up as an officer. And really, what I needed at the time was that discipline that the military instilled in order to put that stuff in place in school. Because I think I was 3 years in, and I was partying hard. I was doing some of my friends would call the Wild Bill thing. And I mean, my grades were good and whatnot, but I just never showed up to class. It was always that end of things. So it kind of fell apart, and I ended up doing some exciting stuff, more adventure things. I was with a BMW race team, and they would race road tracks, so Lime Rock Park, Road Atlanta, Watkins Glen, and I was having a blast there. And the girl that I had met in college, she went a different path, and I was heartbroken. and stuff. And I started to spiral, and I was like, you know what? I always wanted to do the military, and we're still at war and stuff, and we're losing good people out there. Like, why not go yourself, see what it's about? It's something you always wanted to do. And, you know, don't let that chance pass you by. And man, I'll tell you what, I got the full experience, that's for sure.
And how long is the training once you decide, hey, I'm going to join the military? How long do they train you for?
So let's see. So in March, I signed up in March, or I left for basic training in March. And there was a few delays and stuff in the process. But really, I was signing into the unit that I went to on this deployment in December. So you have basic training, then you have airborne school is, 3 weeks, 4 weeks of airborne school. Really, there's a little bit of holdover. So it's about a month. But really, you don't need that much training to fall out of a plane. It's the follow on that when they start teaching you, when you get to division and they start strapping, a 45 pound dry pack on you. So you have this massive rucksack sitting on the front of you, and you have to jump out of these planes with that on and do follow on missions afterwards. That's when it really starts to hit you that, okay, what am I into now?
Because the thing is, I mean, with lots of different qualifications and everything, the amount of years that they have to go through training. But I found, say, the military and the police, I know you're training on the thing, but you're putting your life on the line. And I don't think it's long enough. I mean, because you should be as top as you can get. But when they're kind of putting you out there, I think they're putting you at risk when they're kind of deploying people so early.
Yeah, I mean, you're not wrong there. I mean, that's even... You know, there's additional stuff. Like I went to a separate EMT class that they sent me to that was it 4 or 5 months? So, I mean, we got EMT qualified specifically in the
what's
trauma
EMT?
Area of things. Ah, sorry about that. Emergency medical training. So like classes with people that would be in ambulances, like those first responders. So they sent us to those. So really their thinking was to deal with the traumatic ends, and we would actually do rotations with the local hospital. We had to do, and get qualified on that end. So it's like, they'll teach you, what's called a CLS class, combat lifesaver. It's the bare basics. It's like, oh, someone's bleeding out and you throw a tourniquet on it and how much you crank it down. To where EMT, they're getting into the chest seals, and, they'll teach you the basics of, giving IVs and sticking people, although they tell you like, oh, you're not supposed to, but I mean, if you know what you're doing and you're in the situation where it calls for it, at least there's somebody who's been through it a few times. And it's a little different when it's military as opposed to civilian trained, but no, you're absolutely right. I mean, I don't think anything could ever prepare you fully for combat, and you don't fully know how you're going to react until the situation happens in front of you. You're never going to know until it really does. And all you can do is train for it until then. And really that's the most important part, because if once things kick off, you know, you go into that mode of where you don't have time to think about that. And the learning curve is gone at that point. You are just doing. So nothing can ever really prepare you. But when you get thrust into that position, you know, at that point, you better be ready.
And so, like, I know you have two children. Did you have the children while you were both in service?
That was actually one of the things that led the decision to leave service. Me and my wife were dating at the time, and I had actually put in a packet to go to a different area within the military and to try out for this particular unit. So when she came to me and she was like, hey, I'm pregnant, we're gonna have a kid, and we kind of talked about it and everything, and I was like, I made the decision to, you know, really, to put an analogy to it, to jump out that door of the plane and, you know, leave my military service and jump into the family end of things, just because of this particular unit. You can't have anything else you're thinking about. It's either one or the other, and I had to kind of make that decision. I'm like, military life, family. I chose family overall. And I think, honestly, down the road and everything, I think I made the right decision.
So it's hard enough for me to even fathom that, but like when you're actually in the combat zone, what's going on in your head?
Honestly, most times when all this stuff kicked off and all the different instances that we were involved in, one in particular, someone threw a grenade over a wall at us, and this thing hit a tree limb and bounced around the corner, which is the only reason nobody got killed during it, you know, and it just went into full-on firefight. You know, their AKs were clacking, our machine gunner that was on the roof was returning fire, but he was in a position to where he couldn't traverse the gun low enough to effectively fire back at these guys. So he stood up on the roof, shoulder firing this belt fed machine gun, 240 Bravo. So shooting 7.62 linked in these rounds, and he's standing up and their fire is so close. He's hearing it whiz by him, but he's getting splinters in the face from the trees and stuff that are below in the orchard. I mean, he thought he was done. He thought it was all over at this point, and he's just firing back into this, and this full-on commotion moment. And I had the radio at the time, and I'm right below these gunners who are on the roof. I'm right in front of the building, so I'm calling up that we're under fire, you know. And it's just one thing after another. They're getting stacked up, and the squad leader, I'm yelling over to him, hey, do we need extra people out here, because I'm online with the CO. And he's like, we're good. And they flow right out. But afterwards, after everything was said and done, you know, that's when you take that pause and that after, and you kind of go through it. There's no time. And if there is time, something's wrong. You know, if you're hesitating, you need to check that, because that more times than not, whenever people hesitate within a combat situation, that's when someone gets hurt. That's when someone gets killed. It is just that life to that far extreme.
This is kind of a bit touchy now, but like when I look at, say, Confessions of an Economic Hitman and John Perry, and he's kind of saying how many countries been infiltrated by the states and everything. And I mean, I know you're doing what you're told to do, but hindsight, you know, going in, you know, whether people claim it's for democracy or whatever, but when you look at it, like, it's really big boys playing a game with people's lives, both sides of the fence, unfortunately.
You know, and that's some of the things that I came across in writing this, and some of the things when I was talking with the higher echelons, is that, like, when I wrote this book kind of was from the ground. This is the view from the guys that were placed on the ground in there, and the talk of, like, those struggles that you have in dealing with the populace when you're out there, because all you're really trying to do as a soldier, you're trying to stay alive. You're trying to keep your buddies alive. But also the way we looked at it is it was a little different. This wasn't an invasion. You know, we got embedded in with other Afghan police that was right off of one of the other major villages there. And our patrols would mainly, you know, go through these villages, talk to these villagers, try to talk to them and be like, hey, what's happening? How can we provide you security? Not being that standoff person that just wants to kill everything. You know, that's where the misconception comes. They're like, oh, you know, infantry. And really we were thrust into what would normally be a special forces job. And that's to, like, really assist the local populace and to assist their military and their police forces in providing the public security. And that's something we did. I mean, in a way of to where when we first got there, people didn't want to talk to us, you know, and the people hated us. And really that's because of the people that were there before us. They got so skittish to the point to where they weren't even go out on patrol at that point. And they were just in that mindset of everybody's the enemy, kind of, you know, that's not the way to be. And so it took us a little while to get them to start opening up and talking to us. But when we finally started talking to these villagers and they started realizing, like, hey, these guys are different. They have a different motivation behind them. And really, you know, to be at one point to be brought in and said, hey, look, we want you to be able to stay in the village tonight, stay in the mosque. And they put, and that was something that just blew us away. Like, because that's not normally something you would get. That's their sacred place and stuff. And we actually declined that, but we were like, no, absolutely. Because these people were tired of getting pulled out of their houses in the middle of the night, you know, and either beat up, threatened. Some of them, would just get ripped out. They didn't know if they were going to die or not in the middle of the night. There's no security. And to have that over your head all the time, and then to just offer that, hey, you know what? What's the least we can give you? Maybe a good night's rest. But as far as that end of those upper echelons and working through changing over a country and stuff like that, or working through a conflict like that, I didn't really touch on that. I boiled this thing down to that small level. But really, the generals and the stuff I talked to, one of the biggest things was we got into this thing and we didn't really have a plan to get out of it. There was no ultimate plan forward, and we never worked our way out of a job, which is really what we should be doing. If you go into somewhere, you should be assisting the people, not you're there for them. You're there for humanity. You're supposed to be there as a protector, not as, you know, a destroyer unless necessary.
And I can imagine what it must be like for locals, especially children. Is the whole country under fire, or is it only certain regions?
So that particular one was a hot spot. If you looked at where it was in the corridor leading into Kandahar, and this is actually how we ended up there, was that they had a lot of stuff free flowing in and out of Kandahar, and people, you know, really that's what it was, is freedom of movement. You know, all these guys would do is they just dig stuff in the ground. They might bring it so far, and then they dig it, they place it in, they put a cache in, and they mark it. And then those next people come up and they take it and they move it through. There's really no stopping. So a pile of weapons, munitions, just depends, just a cache of whatever. Like, so one particular one that they had dug in, we came up on during a patrol, and these guys were shaving themselves in order to prepare themselves to blow themselves up as a suicide bomber. They had vests there and they had all the explosives and whatnot and the detonators, but this stuff was hidden up like in the hole of a tree. And it was like just the craziest, like, so here's like 50 plus detonators, and it actually affected the op tempo in the area. The amount of landmines and stuff that we were finding or hitting actually slowed down quite a bit, just due to this find. But yeah, they would just place things either in wells, or, you know, you'd be going through an orchard and just find this little dugout, and there'd be weapons or munitions just waiting for somebody or a team to pick them up and in place them, you know, in order to do harm.
Okay. Have you kind of captured any of the guys that were attempted to be suicide bombers? Because I'd love to get into their head, because, I mean, I've come across plenty of people in cults, and you kind of understand how they're brainwashed into it. But being in a cult and actually, you know, committing suicide for, you know, what they believe in.
There's two sides of that. And we saw everything from, like, so those particular guys, they, of course, they grabbed up some AKs that were on the ground that were next to them and started shooting at us. You know, which of course we went into react to contact, and they got away. You know, we didn't actually end up getting them, but we ended up pulling these all this bomb material out and stuff. But we did end up pulling in a few guys to where there was three of them, and we held them. And after we brought them in, they had been living within the village, and we brought these guys in, and we held them there waiting for Afghan police authority and stuff to come pick them up and bring them to prison and whatnot. But a whole bunch of the village came out and signed affidavits that these people were Taliban, you know, and it was just the fact of, like, everybody was terrified to speak up about it. And they were letting these guys operate right under our noses. But as far as the mind of a suicide bomber, you know, I wasn't here for this one, but the guys, the story that was going around was they came across a child that he was trying to hit a button. He was trying to hit a detonator. And this is this small child, I mean, like 10-year-old, that they put a vest on. And he's weak and stuff, but they told him that, you know, if he went up to the Americans and hit this, that he would go straight to heaven. And to have that sort of twisted mentality, like, I don't think that that's anything that really has a place out there. You know, I mean, that's straight evil, you know, going against something like that. You know, I can understand, and I actually, you know, on one end, I would love to talk to, you know, not in any sort of angry way or whatnot, but love to talk to some of the combatants and the people we faced over there, like sort of in a warrior to warrior capacity, because I respect that. I mean, I respected the fact that, you know, that's terrifying. You know, you have these guys that are in a third world country in the middle of nowhere, you know, with fighting a modern day conventional army force with huge amounts of resources behind it. And, you know, quite essentially the insurgents, you know, it's like the rebellion. And to look at it in the way of, you know, yeah, exactly. Like, place yourself in their shoes and look at it. Like, what are they seeing? Why are they fighting you? Are they fighting you to protect their families, which they weren't? A lot of these guys that we would have come across were actually foreign fighters, you know, on a jihad. So we would run them through a biometric system and stuff afterwards, and we'd catch anything from Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, like where these people had been sighted and seen before due to fingerprints or retinal scan. And this is just through different techniques. That
is this a financial thing? Because, like, I've seen that in a few different situations. Like, I mean, are these people fighting because they're getting paid to go into the different places to fight? I know they're putting their life at risk.
Definitely. Oh, definitely. I mean,
so who's paying them? I mean, who's actually funding this? Because it looks like when you start digging holes, when you start taking off a few layers, it looks like it's the same people that are doing.
That's crazy. Yeah. You know, and if you think about it, it is. If you back up and follow the money and you start looking at it that way, is this just something to perpetuate the war machine? You know, it's entirely possible. I have no idea. But I definitely know that, you know, money is a major motivator. That's that grenade incident, that the compound that it was tossed from, after they went into it, and the locals that had been living there were in there, and they had found a big stack of Taliban money. They had been paid off, you know, to, hey, we're going to stay in here. We're going to shoot at the Americans when they come in, and we're going to throw in here some money, you know, thanks for letting us stay here. And it's, the old man was terrified, you know, and quite honestly, in that type of high stress situation, when they went in to clear this house after being shot at and almost blown up with a grenade, they did the right thing. You know, I mean, here's this guy in the house, and I'm so surprised, because he went to come out of the door as they were coming in, you know, and he just got taken to the ground instead of shot up. Most people would have pulled the trigger on that one just because it was just right there. And to be able to have that, I guess, discipline, you know, and training to recognize that he was no longer, you know, he was not the threat, and the threat had disappeared. But yeah, they went through, and they, in going through everything, they just found this huge stack of money, and it was like, what is this? Well, you know, and they admit to it. They know. But at the same time, what choice do they have?
With the weapons that you recover, I mean, Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, I believe, are the big providers in the States. Who's actually giving them the weapons? Where are the weapons coming from?
That's all stuff I wouldn't be able to, I'm not the guy to talk to about that, you know? I'm not sure.
Because I keep saying, always follow the money and you'll find out who's actually pulling the strings. Like, and it's, you know, because there's somebody providing them with the weapons to, you know.
Oh, they literally in So in the special operations schoolhouse, they have economists. They have like literal doctorate degree economists. That's their job. They look at countries' economies and they look at where the money's flowing. They look at the corruption levels and stuff. And they come up with these situations and they game a whole bunch of stuff and they kind of put culture into it and whatnot. But they're constantly looking at these situations and looking at, you know, that's one of the things, follow the money. You know, you want to find the source of the conflict, follow the money. And when you start using some of the programs they have and some of the things to find out connections and networking and where the pieces all fit in the pie, it's crazy when you start seeing these clear lines of corruption money and like where stuff is flowing. And it's just wild.
So with the book, I haven't read it, but I've looked online and I know it's only recently released, but it's like, it's got 9 5-star reviews, nothing less. And there's like some beautiful comments, like, you know, really, really decent reviews. You know, they're not just kind of a one liner. Like, so when somebody goes to the, you know, the trouble of actually writing something decent, it means it really touched them. And I heard you on another show that there was people that were reading it and they felt the smells. I'd love you to touch on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I really got the guys involved with this thing because I wanted to make sure. There was another book that came out and it kind of challenged a few of the things that the guys had thought about. And they were like, hey, this didn't happen like that, or this wasn't the case. And it got a lot of them talking. And I'm like, well, if that's the case, like, let's put something together that's historically accurate. And like, let's make sure. And it's going to be a pain in the butt, but like, let's do it. Let's talk. Let's go back and forth. Let's triangulate these situations. And that's sort of like within this book, getting those accuracies in there, but then also putting it in such a way to where it's written at a high school level, and it's written at a high school level for a reason. It's supposed to be an easy read, but it's also supposed to be for anybody to pick up and kind of understand this is what these soldiers go through. And like really somebody who's considering maybe joining up, you know, or someone that's about to be thrust into a wartime situation. It's really it's a good read on that end. It's just simple, but getting these guys involved in it was one of the most rewarding things out of the whole project, because number one, you're talking with some of your old friends, about some of the best of and some of the worst of times. But, when you boil it down like that, and when you get it to where, I mean, I've had more recent calls from guys saying that they, you know, they broke down in tears at one point, when they remembered certain things and like, man, I had totally forgotten. I had blocked this stuff out in the past. And, you know, as they're reading this thing and I'm getting this feedback of they're actually getting olfactory senses and they're smelling things from the battlefield, not things in their house. They're smelling things that were on the battlefield, or they're having cravings for cigarettes and they haven't smoked for, you know, 5-10 years. That end shows that picture was vividly painted, at least for somebody who was there before. You know, I can't speak for everybody. I know some civilians and stuff have jumped on there, because I know one of the reviews is from someone that we know from my daughter's scouts meetings. There was a parent down there and I saw you had a book, and like, and then they read it and I'm like, oh God, like, you know, but no, they had a lot of good things to say about it. And, you know, again, a lot of these copies, I sent out a lot of advanced PDFs, like most of the guys, and tried to get all of the guys, copies. I'm not in touch with everybody, but, got these guys the copies of the book, you know, and we had been bouncing stuff back and forth, but I would keep it to like these particular ones so that they didn't have a full picture of the whole thing, but the incidences they were involved in. But when you expand on it and it becomes the whole book, they read through this whole timeline. That was one of my things in doing this. The timeline was very jumpy. So when we had to put it into, kind of a flowing on where that happened and stuff, and they're reading through this and it's all starting to flood back. Just, I was a little worried about some of those effects. But now that now that I am having them read it, or, you know, one of the guys read it in one night, and one of the guys that was there and was just like, call me 5 in the morning, you know, and I freaked out. I honestly, I didn't know why I was getting this call from this person. Anybody that I was with back then, I have them on something to where even if my phone's on do not disturb, it still rings. And I was worried. I was like, oh man, like with hearing that, some of these effects that the guys had that were clearly linking these traumatic events that they went through to what they were experiencing and reading in the book, and it was bringing this stuff back. I kind of had these fears of like, you know, why am I getting this call? So I pick up, you know, he's like, oh wow, I just meant to leave a message. And I'm like, no, I was actually just about to start working out. But you know, what's going on? And he just broke down. He was like super appreciative of everything. And we talked for, you know, my workout for the day was out the window, but we talked for over an hour, and it was like old times. It was like, just catching back up with an old friend. So with some of that opening up that trauma, come some good. And these guys, the ones that did share and the ones that have shared and are continuing to share, it almost seems to be like a therapeutic thing for them. And I know writing the book was for me. It kind of slowed me down enough to really take in everything that actually happened over there, as opposed to, I mean, you've seen some of the accolades that are out there of, you know, finished business school in 2.5 years. And then I went on to do some stuff in the Ivy League. And I just finished up with Columbia Business School, you know, started the business. And really a lot of that has been going full speed, almost running away from some of this. So to be able to slow down and realize that and realize, hey, you have some things that you still have to work on. But it's been good. It really has been good.
And I saw as well that you had to get it kind of like approved by the Department of Defense. So
yes.
What was the process? I understand it because obviously you can't be, you know, giving away trade secrets. But what was it like for you to kind of get, I presume it was like when you get your mortgage letter kind of documentation back and it's all blacked out? Like,
yes. Yes, it was. And that was wild to have come back. And I was just like, man. And a lot of that had to do with that. We worked a bunch with special operations in there. Like we ran a lot of outer cordon QRF, and we ran some stuff with them out there. They were definitely active in our area. A lot of this stuff, we built targeting packages and stuff for higher echelons that would come in and take care of the rest of it. But that the process wasn't that bad, and everybody says it's painful, and maybe I just got lucky because they had it approved within 3 months. You know, I mean, I just sent everything in, went through the channels. There's basically a framework rundown on the DoD side of things when you submit manuscripts. And I mean, I got word back. They opened up my case and, you know, I sent it in, and 3 months later I had it back, you know, with the black lines and stuff. But after getting it back so quickly, I kind of reached out and I was like, hey, what's your former background? And the guy came on there and he's like, well, I was infantry. And he's like, I really like this book. So we kind of pushed you to the front. So it was, we got lucky. There's so many instances within writing this thing and within putting it together to where I don't know if it's the universe just kind of moving it forward where it's like, hey, people need to hear this story. I can't explain it any other way, because I, honest to God, it's my first actual book out on the market. I've written some other stuff before, but for this to go on the path that it has, and then also to be accepted in the Library of Congress, and now my local library has a copy, and you know, I just got word that the New York Times is taking a look at it as well. So I mean, to do that and to be able to jump through these hoops, if I can do that, you know, as somebody who is a lower enlisted on the ground, man, just the potential out there in some of these guys, and using the discipline that was instilled behind them in the military in order to whether put it into a business end or another venture or your kids or really anything you do in life. Those routines and sticking to the plan, you know, and adjusting as needed. All stuff that you learn in the military, if you learn how to translate it over correctly, you've really been set up for success. You just need to realize it.
I'd love to know your thoughts on when the Americans did pull out of Afghanistan and left all the weaponry behind. What was going on in your head and your mates' heads as well when you saw something like that?
So a lot of guys look at that, and I mean, I hear everything. I hear it all from we should have never been there in the first place to, man, what a giant cluster. At my level, you know, really all I can say is that it's clear it wasn't properly planned. It's clear there was not a proper handoff. I mean, to have that country run through within days, you know, after we left. Yeah, I mean, it's crumbling as we're leaving. You know, you're seeing these videos of people trying to get on planes and Afghan refugees. And, you know, you have Americans that reached out and are doing stuff on their own, even, you know, forming nonprofits such as there's one out there, Save Our Allies, that they're out there trying to get these people out that assisted Americans. You know, there was interpreters. There's actually one of them, Johnny, that they got out, and he was one of our old interpreters within, so he was with, I think he was with 2nd Platoon. I was with 1st, but all these guys operated together. And I mean, I know Johnny, I know, one of our other interpreters, Gucci, great people, you know, just a great human being. And to leave behind people that either we made promises to, or that assisted us, putting their own life on the line, and then just, all right, well, sorry, didn't work out. That's doesn't fall right on anybody. I mean, that's just not the way to be. And as far as that end, that's where I think America kind of needs to reevaluate and say, you know, what are we doing here? What is the mission? What's your ultimate goal? And like, what are you trying to accomplish? You know, and what are these people trying to accomplish? What's best for them? It's quite honestly, I mean, what I don't know how bad the situation was before we even, I mean, we went into there, you know, and they're still recovering from Russian conflict era stuff, which is why you had Al-Qaeda and these different bad actors taking advantage of a place's training grounds. So, I mean, you already have a corrupt country, but like, what do they have? What is it like now? You know, you hear about it's worse. It's even worse than it was before we even got there. So, you know, really it's about going in with a plan, you know, and it's even speaking with some of the generals and stuff too. That's one of their things is like, we went in there and you told me to, I think Petraeus actually said it recently in an interview. He was told, you know, well, what are we doing after? And they were like, just get us there. Just get us to this point in the mission stuff. And if you operate like that, like just one step at a time and not looking at that ultimate goal, you're just going to perpetually put yourself in it or you're going to fail.
I hear a load of kind of vets suffering from PTSD, and it's usually veterans create the nonprofits or helping them. And I know you're involved in something like that as well, that you're helping them. Is it the government kind of says, here, off you go, fight, and you come back and they wash their hands? Are they offering any support for people that have been seen traumatic kind of things while on duty?
Yeah, they've come a long way with that stuff. I know they were sort of, as I was leaving active duty, they had a lot more programs that they were focusing on with that. So there was a lot more. Matter of fact, I kind of assisted. I have my own story where I assisted this guy, and this isn't even in the book. This is much later, but he looked as if just something was wrong. something wasn't right. He was about, I think it was 2 weeks from leaving the service and being separated from the service. And most guys, when that's happening, they got a big grin on their face. And this guy was just moping around. And I'm just like, hey, what's going on, man? Like, you all right? Oh, no, I'm fine, Sergeant. And I'm like, no, man. Like, hey, nobody else is here. Come back to my office. And I just sat down with him for a little bit. And he started pouring his guts out. And he didn't know how to deal with life, really. It was coming crashing down on him. And it was a lot of these things just stacked up. These guys can handle a lot of stuff. They're asked a lot. But when you start piling on thing after thing after thing, I mean, there's a huge focus these days in mental health as it is. But when you pile on that last weight, and a lot of us take on a lot of weight, sometimes it can be too much. And he was at his snapping point. And when he went to me, he said, you know, he's like, well, I'm out in 2 weeks. I haven't done anything to get out. And that's because I'm, you know, thinking about going and just killing myself. You know, that's what's all this for. And I looked at him and I was like, well, what do you want? And he's just like, I don't know. I'm like, okay, what would be your ultimate goal? And we talked for a bit and I'm like, all right, I'm like, I'll help you through this, but you got to trust me on this. And I went to the first sergeant, and believe it or not, first sergeant actually was zero help at all. He actually told me to get this guy out processed out quicker than, you know, he's like, I don't want him to be a problem. I'm like, you freaking kidding me? Like, this is your job. This is ultimately like your thing. This is keeping your guys alive. This is taking care of your people. So I also kind of had to put myself under fire and I was like, okay, that's cool. So I went back to the kid and I'm like, hey, walk with me, man. We're going to go see Sergeant Major. They just jumped the next run. And we went down and we got him down to the clinic, you know, and I basically stayed with him as well as I was a platoon sergeant at the time. So I not only now had my own platoon and this kid wasn't even mine, but I now had, you know, I was given this guy now because he was the problem and I brought it up to take care of him and get him out processed the right way. I was like, okay, fine. I'm like, all right. But we got him out processed, but we got him the mental health that he needed. The issues were taken care of. At least he started seeing clinicians and everything. I mean, but ultimately it was somebody just sitting down and talking with. And I think that a lot of the problems that are within the military on that end are also problems that stem within our society. We're so disconnected these days to where we can't even recognize, you know, when somebody's going through something. They've got their, you know, you see it all the time. They got their face down in their phone as opposed to looking you straight in the eyes or, you know, looking around as they walk. That attention and that focus is elsewhere. And it's not about, they're not present in their life. And I think that's one of the biggest issues. It's not just military. I think it's just amplified throughout military service members.
Absolutely. Listen, William, I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation, but what I'd love is to get you back in Q1 of 2024. And what I'll do is I'll have like a questionnaire on the episode when it goes out. So those that have listened to it can have questions for when you come back. And also those that read the book might have some questions as well. So you might let people know where they can find you.
Yeah. So there's an official website at damnthevalleybook.com. And from there, you can kind of see, you can get the book on, you know, you can either get a signed copy from there, which helps me enable for every 2 signed copies that I sell, I am able to get 1 copy out to the guys that were actually there in the story. That's kind of my way of giving back through this. That's the only reason there's author signed copies that are up for sale on the web. But I mean, you can go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org. As well, and check out the social media campaigns, because like in writing this thing, everything about it, I wanted to kind of provide people with the best possible picture and the most value from a book. So I mean, it's not just a book. Every single picture that's up there, well, most of, not all of, but all the pictures that I post up there on the regular, the daily ones, are all pictures actually from that deployment and that were submitted from the guys that were on there. So you have almost a year's worth of pictures of these regions and the stuff that we did. Because I'm really trying to give people that picture of what we went through and the most value that they can possibly get from this book. I'm just trying to give back here.
Love it.
So
love
damnthevalleybook.com.
No, brilliant. I'll make sure I put the link spot on the audio and the video. Thank you very much.
Roy, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
No problem. So that's all for the Speaking Podcast. You'll find all our episodes on speakingpodcast.com. Until next week, take care. Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Be sure to give us a thumbs up, 5-star rating, and share with your friends. And you'll find all my shows with the QR code or bio.link/podcaster, as well as my podcast coaching. And I'd like to thank my sponsor, danielpacker.com, helping people with anxiety, stress, and addictions. He's got a 90% success rate, and you only pay if you're successful. Also, if you'd like to go on a podcasting tour, I can help you do that. And if you're interested in sponsorship, you can contact me on my bio.link/podcaster. Until next week, take care.